Hello, and welcome to the Sleep Science Podcast. I'm Penny Lewis, a neuroscientist specializing in sleep and memory, and the presenter of this show. In the podcast, we talk about all things related to sleep, from dreaming and sleepwalking to what sleep does for our brain and body, and how we can get more out of our sleep. Please see our sleep science web pages for details. Today's episode is part two of our discussion with Professor Tora Nielsen from the University of Montreal and Professor Mark Blagrove from Swansea University about their work on dreams. In part one, we talked about what kinds of things dreams contain and the possible function of nightmares. In part two, we move on to discuss the potential positives and negatives of lucid dreaming and our guest's work on the dreamlike effect, a phenomenon in which memories are incorporated into dreams on the night after they happen, and also around 6 to 7 days later, but mysteriously not in between. We'll talk about why this odd gap in dream incorporation happens and what it may mean for memory and consolidation. You can listen to part two by itself, but you may enjoy it more if you start by listening to part one of the conversation. Either way, I hope you'll find our discussion interesting. So, Tori, you've done some work on something called imagery rehearsal. And my understanding is that this is a method that can help to reduce nightmares. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure, yes. It's some of my past work. I'm not really doing that anymore. But when Anne Germain was working in my lab, we were quite interested in it. Valerie Samar as well. She was interested in nightmares in children. So we did a few studies where we tried this imagery rehearsal. And the basic idea is simply that, you know, a nightmare can be manipulated while awake. So if there's some aspect of the nightmare that you feel that you could change to make the outcome more acceptable to you, you do that. And then you rehearse this changed scenario or script of the nightmare so that it's more of a positive dream. And you do that on a regular basis during wakefulness always. And yeah, the basic finding is that this tends to generalize into dreaming so that the nightmares diminish, they become less threatening, and other symptoms tend to wane as well. So we did this with adults who suffered either from idiopathic nightmares, that is nightmares we don't know the reason for, and also post-traumatic nightmares, nightmares that we definitely know the reason for. And then we also, in a second study, we did the same kind of intervention with children who, instead of rehearsing these scenarios mentally, they would draw them out, right? They would take their nightmare and then they would draw out a better outcome for themselves. And they would do that on a daily basis. So they rehearse, but, you know, in a medium more conducive to children. And in both cases, there was success. The therapy reduced the nightmares, also tended to reduce anxiety and symptoms related to the nightmares. And of course, this has been shown now in numerous studies, like post-traumatic stress disorder victims, their nightmare frequency will decrease and their, you know, depression will decrease, their anxiety will decrease. Targeting the nightmare seems to be a very effective way of treating the whole range of symptoms related to trauma, but also idiopathic nightmares for which we really don't know the cause. So the actual mechanism is still unclear. Some people have tried to, you know, sort of break down the elements of treatment. For example, in our study, we used the classical treatment, which is have people together in a group. So once you have people in a group, many things happen. There's social support, there's interaction, people are exchanging information, they're talking about sleep hygiene factors, and they're doing much more than just learning about this rehearsal technique. And it could be that some of these other factors are at play. And the studies so far that have tried to disassemble sort of the parts of treatment are suggesting that it may not only be the drawing or the rehearsing that is effective, but other things as well.
It's about rehearsing it in a safe place. That's the idea, right?
Yes, you could say that. It's also about learning about control. That is, learning that you actually can have a say in what is taking place at a sort of unconscious level. And it's surprising to me how many people aren't really aware of that. They feel sort of at the mercy of their nightmares. And when you start to suggest, well, you know, there's something you can do about this, it's not that complicated. And some people respond immediately once they have this aha moment, like, oh, I can actually intervene myself. But also, if you look at the contents of nightmares as they change through therapy, you will see that there is this increase in control in the actual content itself, as if this element of control is somehow getting, it's a seed that's being installed into the content of the nightmares.
One of the things that's so interesting about this finding is that although the control may very well be deliberate when one is awake and one can learn to be more in control and feel more of a sort of a internalized control person, that during the nightmares or during the dreams, it's not deliberate there. And so this is quite different from ideas that by having lucid dreams, you could deliberately alter the content of a nightmare. That's a completely different issue. What this one is saying is that if you affect people's cognition while they're awake and their habitual types of cognitions, that can then affect how they produce the plot of the dream during the night. And that's one of the really theoretically interesting ideas here, that we don't know that we're producing the plot of the dream while it's being produced. You know, there's nothing deliberate about that. And that's why they feel like they happen to us, these dreams. And the weird thing is that this therapy can affect our habitual levels of control when we're awake. And yet when we're asleep, that new habitual level, you know, without us having to think about it, affects the way in which we produce a dream and the plot of a dream. So it's a bit similar to work on here on lucid dreams. And we found that people who feel more in control in their waking life are more likely to have more lucid dreams. So it's a similar thing, that your habitual types of cognition, almost like a personality when you're awake, shows itself in your dreams. And thankfully, in this case, the therapy alters their habitual way of seeing their level of control and agency when they're awake. And then they produce dreams which are a bit more in tune with that.
It also sounds as though it's almost turning what we talked about earlier on its head, because earlier we talked about nightmares or else triggering replay of negative memories during REM as a way of making those, either the nightmares or the memories, less negative, so that in subsequent wake, people would find them less upsetting. And now we're talking about kind of working through negative stories or nightmare themes, scenarios in wake, that's going to influence what happens in subsequent sleep, and those nightmares will not be as bad in subsequent sleep. So if I'm understanding correctly, really, it sounds like we're talking about a two-way process here where you can work on these things in either wake or sleep, and it will influence what happens in the other domain of consciousness. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, because if a person was to go into some kind of psychotherapy dealing with their anxiety, strictly with their anxiety, but not necessarily with their nightmares, and they successfully bring down their levels of anxiety, it's likely that their nightmares will also decrease. So the point that you made earlier about the rehearsal therapy as sort of producing a safe context is probably key here, because yes, getting together in a group is supportive and does impart safety. And it may very well be that the changes are occurring during wakefulness and that these are just simply being reflected in the nightmares. As Mark mentioned earlier, it may just be that we dream about our waking negative emotions, but there's no function necessarily happening during the dreams or the nightmares. It could be that the key changes are occurring during wakefulness, and what we're seeing in the nightmares is simply an echo of that. We still don't have evidence one way or the other as to what's going on there. Maybe targeted memory reactivation together with the therapy, using some variation of rehearsal therapy, could produce a design that also could bring to the surface the mechanism that's at play.
And I also think we shouldn't dismiss lucid dreaming in this mix of ideas, right? So Mark, you mentioned it just now, but you mentioned it as in, you know, this imagery rehearsal concept is quite different than the idea of controlling negative things that might happen to you during sleep through lucid dreaming, because the point is then you are lucid. And the problem that we're dealing with the imagery rehearsal is that people are not in control, so they're not lucid. However, nevertheless, in a previous podcast on lucid dreaming with Michelle Carr and Karen Konkoly, we talked about the idea that lucid dreaming could be used as a way of modifying your feelings, your thoughts about negative situations by choosing different outcomes in your dreams.
Yes, that's right. And that's a possible very positive feature of lucid dreams. There's a bit of a debate going on at the moment in the literature about the degree to which lucid dreams are a positive thing or not. And our attempts to have lucid dreams, actually, unless you're needing to have them, say, for these nightmare instances or for a little bit of entertainment, that will they often be more negative than positive? Because, you know, you have to disrupt your sleep often in order to train to have them. And if you do have them, you may very well be having dreams which are not the type of dreams which, if dreaming has a purpose, you ought to be having, you know, because you're busy controlling it and not having the more spontaneous, creative dreams that certainly under certain theories we need to be having for a purpose of dreaming. They may very well have their therapeutic uses in some instances, lucid dreams, but there is debate about their general desirability, despite the fact obviously there are many proselytizers for the idea of having lucid dreams and having fun in lucid dreams. Yes.
No, I think that's a great point, Mark, because we don't know what all the functions of dreams are. So we may be interfering by intentionally, say, engineering dreams to go one direction or another. We may inadvertently be cutting ourselves off from an entire range of functions that we don't know about. To give an odd example, I think of the dreams that shamans used to have in sort of tribal societies, where they would dream of leaving their bodies and interact with the gods and, you know, obtain medicines and ideas and, you know, go to battle and so forth. And these are very realistic dreams of the kind that we might call lucid today, but their emphasis wasn't on becoming lucid and aware that they're dreaming. Their emphasis was on, you know, marshaling their power so that they could fight the demons or, you know, whatever. You know, this kind of big dream, this dream that contributes to their entire tribe, could easily be short-circuited by this short-term focus on just becoming lucid.
Yes. And of course, all the work being done, you know, around the world on the characteristics of dreaming and their relationship to waking life, majority of that's done on ordinary non-lucid dreams. And so if there is a theoretical work and aspirations that we may find some function of those, they may very well be short-circuited and disrupted by lucidity. You know, and one of the claims there is that, in fact, we may have evolved not to have lucidity in our dreams. And the fact that it's so difficult and so rare, you know, I think it's supposed to be something like 2-3% of REM dreams being lucid. The reason it's so rare that we can realize where we're dreaming while we're dreaming is that possibly it's been selected out so that we can have these simulations when we're asleep that we experience without having to have a whole load of metacognition and thinking, ah, I know I'm dreaming. So it's a possibility that metacognition, which we've got when we're awake, has been removed.
So I tend to agree with that. If you look subjectively, if you try to have lucid dreams yourself, you will be amazed at how creative your own dreams are in attempting to thwart the achieving of lucidity, as if there are these mechanisms built in to prevent it from happening.
So maybe it's adaptive for us to be able to have dreams without feeling that we can control them.
Or
without feeling responsible.
Well, I wouldn't go too far, because I tend to think that some amount of control is useful, and the lucid dreaming training methods now available with, you know, Michelle's new method, the lucid dreaming reactivation method, it perhaps, if not used to excess, perhaps if only used to a certain extent, just enough to give the dreams an element of control, may be more useful for nightmare treatment than having full-blown lucidity, which tends to be distracting very often because it's so exciting and thrilling to be able to control. But to be able to control just a little bit actually might push the dreamer in the right direction of dealing with their emotional baggage.
Lots of food for thought there on lucid dreams. I want to move us on now to talk about something else that you've both done a lot of work on, which is the dream lag effect. Tori, I think this was your work originally. Can you explain what the dream lag effect is?
Sure. I'll tell you where it came from. Back when I was a graduate student working with Don Kuiken, my colleague Russ Powell and I were interested in a lot of factors related to dreams, but Russ brought into the equation these early sociological studies on imitation murders and or imitation suicides and imitation murder suicides. Back in the 70s and early 80s, a fellow named David Phillips, he showed that there was quite an interesting relationship between publicized murders, you know, newspaper stories about murders or about suicides, and sort of copycat suicide later on. And he found that there was this delay. In some cases, it was a 3 to 4 day delay. In the case of airplane crashes, it was a 6 to 7 day delay. And airplane crashes might not obviously seem like an imitation of anything, but the idea is that a murder suicide can be copied by sort of crashing your vehicle containing other people, you know, intentionally. So you have motor vehicle head-on collisions and aircraft crashes and so forth. And in fact, there are these delays between the actual publicization of the event of a murder-suicide and these airplane crashes. Anyway, we thought, seems like it could be an unconscious kind of an event. Maybe something similar is happening in dreams. And I had noticed that in my own dreams as well. There were sometimes these delays, if you look very closely, in having an experience and then dreaming about it, say a week later. So we set about to do some studies where we picked experiences and then looked for them in dreams and found, not surprisingly, that people dreamed about these experiences the next day or the next night, the next opportunity, but also about a week later. And in between, there seemed to be a total absence of those experiences on days 3 and 4 or following. And that might actually be even a more reliable finding than the dream lag effect, is this absence of effect, but at days 3, 4. And we're skeptical. We thought it was maybe just, you know, good fortune. So we replicated it, and we actually replicated the finding several times with similar results, but always with caveats like, well, it was always certain types of subjects, you know, those who incorporated easily versus those who didn't, or sometimes with females, but not with males. We're still skeptical. I still am to this day, but I guess when Mark came along and with Elaine Van Rijn and replicated this 25 years later, I want to point out, it took that long before somebody actually went in and independently replicated the finding and found further support for it. That I was so happy when you found that.
Oh, great. Yes. Yes. I mean, we first replicated it with Josie Henley-Einion doing a massive study in which people kept a record of dreams for 2 weeks and their diaries for 2 weeks. And then in an entire matrix, they compared every dream to every diary record, whether the diary comes from before the dream or after the dream. It was absolutely massive. And so that was the first big replication that we managed to do on that. So we did it with her. And then another one with Jean-Baptiste Eichenlaub, which was in Journal of Sleep Research in 2019, we had the highest number of participants for a dream lag study, and that had 19 participants for which we found the effect. And each person had to do multiple comparisons and providing multiple data points of comparisons between dreams and daily diaries. And so each person is providing hundreds of data points, because, you know, dream on day 6 has to be compared to diary on day 2. Or dream on day 8 has to be compared to diary on day 7. You know, so you get a massive array in this matrix. And so we managed to get that with Jean-Baptiste Eichenlaub. And then as was just said, with Elaine, we found that it was occurring for REM sleep and not slow wave sleep, and with Josie Henley-Einion for REM sleep dreams and not stage 2 dreams. And so the skepticism, or rather the worry that Torre's got and I've always still got as well, that this can't really be true. But when we got a whole load of slow wave sleep dreams and stage 2 dreams, and we do exactly the same method to them, and it's not there, it's weird. So it really does look like, for some reason, you start to dream of things that happened about 6 days ago. And the really big reason why it's so theoretically really important is that almost all theories of dreaming can account for the day residue effect, which is we tend to dream of what happened to us yesterday. Now, if dreaming has no function at all, people who believe that, there's a book by Owen Flanagan called Dreaming Souls, which is the gold standard skepticism of dreaming having a function book. And it's a lovely paperback. And people like that can readily accept that, well, we dream of what happened to us yesterday because it's still on our mind. And so the fact that we dream of things that happened to us yesterday, even the fact that we tend to dream of the emotional things rather than the non-emotional things, is itself not really a pointer towards the dreams doing anything or having any function. But the fact that you start to dream of things that happened 6 days, 5, 6 or 7 days ago, that is very strange. It's very difficult to explain why that would happen unless there was something going on neurally that had that type of time span for processing to be occurring. And just to mention that, you know, when I was very skeptical about when the theory first came out and the findings first came out, when I heard about them a very long time ago when Torrey was doing them. And the classic skeptical point of view is, you're not dreaming of what happened to you 7 days ago. You're dreaming of what happened to you yesterday. But because your life is regular, therefore matches things you were doing a week ago as well. And the first paper with Josie Henley-Einion got rid of that possibility. So we showed that that really wasn't true. We partly because of matching the dream to things that happened 6 or 7 days in the future. There wasn't a match there. So we did various clever things in that paper to just show that that skeptical account wasn't there. And so we are left with this really perplexing issue that it seems to be specific to REM sleep dreams. It seems to be specific to sort of emotional events that happen to us. And it seems to be there at that time span.
It's true that the replications that you did not only had more subjects than ours, but also were better controlled than ours in, as you described, comparing all possible days with all possible dreams and so forth. This is something that we did not do. And there was always problems with our designs. We didn't have the resources really to overcome. But the time of day effect is an important one, because there is this 7 day circa septin rhythm that tends to, you know, have effects in strange ways. Like, I don't know, people tend to do Google searches on the term healthy more often on Monday and Tuesday than they do on Wednesday through Sunday. So there's a peak of interest, or even if you look at COVID-19, there are more infections and deaths on Thursday and Friday than there are on, say, Sunday and Monday. So there are these weak.
Is this kind of like people going on diets in January after Christmas?
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, those kinds of effects are there. But copycat suicide idea is an important one. If you look even recently, you know, the shootings in Atlanta recently that killed some eight people was followed 6 days later by a serious shooting in Colorado. You know, this kind of thing could be looked at in this respect. The highly publicized, and there is a relationship between the level of publicity of certain things and whether or not they will appear, you know, a week later. Anyway, those are factors that I think could be looked at with respect to dreams, and specifically, as Mark mentioned, the neural level. If you ask people about the sources of their dreams, they won't easily tell you that something happened 6 days ago. They really have to reflect on it and just remember what they did 6 days ago. Those kinds of memories are really not that obvious. When you provide them with, say, a calendar, or you have them focus really on what happened a week before, they will often have these aha experiences where they say, oh, that's right. I was at a movie or watching a movie and such happened, which was exactly like in the dream. You know, the memories are there, but they're lurking. We've been relating this to sort of hippocampal function and episodic memory, looking at whether dreaming may be another form of sort of hippocampally mediated long-term memory storage. And yeah, we have a little bit of evidence that the dream lag dreams, you know, the later ones, do treat things like spatial imagery or social interactions more so than the immediate dreams, and that those are functions that are mediated a lot by the hippocampus.
Maybe it's also worth just explaining the setup of these dream-lag experiments. So how does it work? How do you know where the memories are coming from when they're coming into the dreams?
Well, I could mention the earlier studies that were less controlled than Mark's, just to give sort of a baseline, where something like a subject stays in the lab for a night and then they go home and they keep a diary for a week or 2 weeks. So the experience of staying in the lab is very striking, very memorable. And we can subsequently look at instances of the lab in their follow-up dreams. And there we can see these patterns. I think Mark has done a study like that. I've done a study like that. But Mark went beyond that to do a more sort of statistically rigorous approach.
What we did at Swansea then was to say, what type of memories is it that are evidencing the dream lag? And so the diaries we got people to keep, they would have to each day write down their five major daily activities, like, you know, I had lunch in the cafeteria or I walked to work. They would report five personally significant events, which were usually quite emotionally, you know, slightly or quite emotionally charged, and then five major concerns that they have. And what they would then do was, after keeping that diary for 14 days, they would match those diary records to the dream reports that they had recorded as well. And they could either record the dreams at home. So sometimes we recorded them at home, or other times we got the dream from them in the sleep lab, which has the advantage that they are then following awakenings from either REM sleep, N2 or slow wave sleep. So we know what stage of sleep the dream was occurring from.
And you found this dream lag effect in REM, not in stage two.
Yes, and we found it for the personally significant events and not for the major activities and not for the concerns. Possibly because the concerns are sort of, they're less time specific than the events.
Yeah, it's such a peculiar kind of phenomena. Now, Tori, you started to explain your ideas about what might be going on in the brain to cause this, but can you just go into that maybe in a little more detail about the hippocampus and the cortex?
Well, I don't know that we've moved much beyond just an interesting theory about sort of dreaming, reflecting longer term steps in memory processing. I think it's pretty well known now that memory storage is not a sort of an immediate event, that there is a kind of a transfer that occurs whereby the initial learning, the initial memory is stored somewhere in the hippocampus for a finite period of time. And during that time, it is transferred to more cortical structures, say the medial prefrontal cortex or, you know, other parietal lobes or so forth. And that after that period of time, the hippocampus is no longer really necessary to retrieve that memory. And this is a mechanism that's been shown in animal studies numerous times. And several of those studies suggest that sort of that window of transfer is about a week or more, which fits with our idea that maybe the dream lag, sort of the delayed dreaming about things, is somehow related to this transfer, although it doesn't really explain why we wouldn't see, for example, dreams about the event on multiple days up until a week later, at which time you might expect it to stop. But, you know, who knows? The mysteries of long-term memory, you know, maybe there are certain steps. There's evidence from animal studies as well that REM sleep responds to learning very often with a one-week window. Rats that learn a maze task, I think Carlisle Smith showed this quite early on, they're percentage of REM sleep will increase after learning for 6-7 days, and then it will decrease. So there is this underlying neural mechanism involved in memory storage. We just don't know exactly how the day residue and dream lag seem to map onto that neural structure. It might be something simple. It might have to do with neurogenesis, for example, which has a finite window as well. It takes at least 7 days for new neurons that are generated in the dentate gyrus and CA1. It takes time for them to come online. But once they are captured by new learning, then they become integrated into the hippocampus. Whether that really maps onto what we're seeing with dream delays, I don't know, and I'm not even sure how I would go about testing that.
Well, one thought that springs to my mind is we have this finding now in a whole series of studies using different tasks where we've triggered reactivation of these tasks in sleep. Sometimes it's REM, sometimes it's non-REM sleep. And we find that the benefit of that targeted memory reactivation, often we see it the next day, but we then see it increasing across the next 10 days or so. And sometimes we don't even see any benefit the next day, and it only becomes apparent after about a week. And that varies from study to study, depending what the task is. But it does, you know, definitely this reactivating of things in sleep seems to lead to an ongoing evolution of the memories, but we're not quite sure what's underpinning that either. So, you know, we have the same problem as you. We are now starting to look at it with MRI, which might help, but let's see, the jury's still out. I think it's a really fascinating phenomena. And I think that if at some point we could pull together kind of MRIs of brain plasticity as a result of triggering memories in sleep and your dream lag effect, that would be awesome, right? That would be amazing. Do you want to add anything on the dream lag effect, either of you?
One thing to add is that there's recently been a replication at a lab in China of it, but I know they found it for one personality variable on, it interacted with a personality variable so that there was only, it was only some of the participants that got it. So at least it's not just the labs in Canada and here. Yeah.
Oh, I could add as well that we have a paper under revision right now in which we demonstrate that, targeted memory reactivation will affect a dream lag differentially depending on whether it's administered in REM or in non-REM sleep. And the TMR is associated with our famous virtual reality flying task. You may have seen the paper we published already. We didn't find that the TMR induced any dreams at all in the lab, but it was only once we looked at the home dreams that we found that when TMR sounds related to the task were given in REM sleep, we found a day residue effect. But when the stimulation was given in non-REM sleep, we found a dream lag effect. And these are from home dreams, so presumably from REM dreams in the morning. So somehow stimulation in non-REM is producing a dream lag effect in the REM dreams at home. And we don't quite know what it means, but in our paper, we discuss some different possibilities.
Well, that sounds really exciting. I'd love to see that one when it comes out.
It hasn't been rejected. And we're revising it now, so we're hoping that it'll be out within a few weeks. Yeah.
Oh, well, would you mind sending me a copy when it comes out or when you're ready to share? I'd love to read that, actually. Yeah.
I won't send Mark a copy.
Okay, so I'm aware that we're running lower on time now. So I want to ask you some future-looking questions. So first question is, what do you see as the really big future questions for dream research?
I still think there really is this big issue still about whether the dreams that are happening to us in the night have an effect in the night. Now, Bob Stickold and Tony Zadra's book that's just out, When Brains Dream, that provides a whole theory behind it of what type of cognition is occurring during the night that makes up for the fact that when we're awake, we have to have very focused thinking occurring. So the idea is that when you're asleep, there is a greater exploration of possibilities occurring and that this occurs during our dreams and that that's part of memory consolidation. It's a sort of more flexible memory consolidation than we are able to do when we're awake. And so really the next one of the next things is to work out how true is that, you know, how true is that that dreams really are reflecting our memory consolidation? Because there's various reasons to be skeptical about that. And so I think that's one of the next things.
So looking at the link between dreaming and consolidation, essentially.
And memory consolidation, you know, and there are papers which seem to provide a link. So Erin Wamsley's work showing that the people who dreamt of a maze task then had greater improvement in their performance across a period of sleep. But with the skeptical side saying, yes, but the people who dreamt of the maze task were the ones who did worse on the task before they went to sleep. So maybe they're dreaming of it because they feel humiliated, embarrassed to have done so badly in the lab. And so maybe the dreams are purely a reflection of waking life before sleep and not a reflection of what's going on during the night in any functional sense. Obviously, the brain's doing things that produces the dream during the night. But whether it's a functional process that's causing the dream is another question entirely. So I guess if people are really into the what's in favour of that, the Zadra and Sickold book provides an extremely good account of that.
Perhaps I could add then just to the idea of dream function, what I think is even currently underway is a growing interest in dream mechanisms. That is, how is it that we dream? How is it that the brain is able to produce this miracle of replication? And the whole dream engineering movement that was started a few years ago, I think, reflects this. It was inspired by people at MIT Media Lab working together with Michelle and basically demonstrating that we now have the technology to influence dreams in a variety of ways while they are occurring. So sources of stimulation like odors that can be, you know, selectively stimulated from a device worn around the neck, or a glove which can selectively stimulate sensory receptors in the fingertips or in the fingers or elsewhere. There's a number of technologies that are now coming online that are really accessible, don't cost much at all, and have the potential for affecting dreams, which would allow us to gain some kind of experimental control over dream formation, which is what is missing really in the whole quest for understanding mechanism. And I think we're going to see more of that. Just the interest in the dream engineering movement right now suggests that that's going to sort of be a complementary area to the function that Mark mentioned.
So that actually leads beautifully into my next short question for you guys, which is, do you see the manipulation of dreams or dreams in general, understanding dreams more as useful in some way, as, you know, for therapies or for creativity or for other things?
I think it's possible it could be therapeutic or creative. And obviously, we've got to do the experiments on that to find out if that is so. The point of caution there, though, is that although from a scientific point of view, it may be very important to alter dreams and to see what the effects of altering dreams are on subsequent waking life variables, all that type of thing, there could be a really good scientific value to it. But there is the possibility that the most fruitful dreams are the ones which occur to us naturally. And I mean, that's again something to be found out empirically. You know, are they the ones that just happen to us that are the most sort of reflective of waking life, and possibly also the ones that produce more important metaphors for our waking life? So although the technology side is very, very important, it could be more important scientifically than socially. That's the only caution I would have there. I mean, that's partly borne out by the current work that we're doing at Swansea, which is that we've done lots of work in the sleep lab and outside the sleep lab relating the content of dreams to waking life. So the waking life records that people have kept in diaries. So we did these very robust studies, which do all of that highly, highly rigorously. We've moved on to do studies in which people report a dream, and we then talk about the dream with them and get the waking life references that way. And there's been great benefit to people from exploring the waking life memory sources that they have for the dream when we have a lengthy discussion of about 50 minutes to them. And there is the possibility that it's really those naturally occurring dreams that are the ones which are going to be more personally meaningful to people. That's an empirical matter, though. It could very well be that the technological side, you know, possibly giving people cues during the night to remind them of what is a concern, could boost these types of dreams where you dream of your concerns and of important events. So it may very well be that we could manipulate the metaphorical side of dreams through these technologies. That's also a possibility. So, those are all possibilities for benefits. Yes.
Yes. No, I think that was exceptionally well said. And my bias, I think, is that the fundamental science is as important as sort of the applied, which I think is what your question is getting at. But there is value in understanding dream mechanisms and dream phenomenology in more detail. And I think that is where the technology is taking us. These ideas of Marx, I think, are excellent, though. But I think there is value in and of itself in understanding the sort of the neural underpinnings to dreaming and being able to, maybe we'll sacrifice a certain number of big spontaneous dreams in order to understand how they work. But ultimately, it's hard to predict where we'll go. I mean, some people are talking about being able to sort of visualize other people's dreams, on a computer screen. 10 years ago, I would have said that was hogwash. But now I see that there is actual progress being made in that direction. And now I'm not as skeptical. I think that it may be possible. And who knows what kind of social effects that would have if it was possible to actually sit down and review your own dream visually or auditorially, or maybe even in virtual reality, somehow reenacted. You could see the film by Wim Wenders, To the End of the Earth. I think it's an old film, which is about that question. What happens to humanity once they can visualize their own dreams? It's a bit bleak, spoiler alert, but it's an interesting movie in that respect, to see the parallels between that movie, which is, I don't know, over 30 years old, I think, and what's happening today.
And it could be possible using classifiers, kind of classifier technology that's coming out that can use EEG activity to work out what the brain is thinking about, right?
Yeah, those are all exciting possibilities of the mechanisms of dreams, altering the mechanisms of dreams as well, so as to cue particular content, that type of thing. The other end of things, though, is something that we've been working on, which is the more social end of them, in which what we'd found after we'd done some years of all this work on discussing dreams with people, we started to move into a more public discussions of dreams with people. So there would be several people engaged in the discussion. And what we started to find was that the people who were discussing the dreams had a greater level of empathy towards the dreamer and an understanding of their life. And we've fitted all this into work on engagement with fiction and the empathy-inducing effect of engagement with fiction. And so the possibility is there that dreams are a type of fiction that we produce, and part of the function could be of telling them to other people. And that when you tell them to other people, you inadvertently blurt out about yourself. And so it's almost like a blush, which evolution has given us, because it's a way of making sure that people don't keep secrets, And so possibly our dreams are also a group bonding mechanism to, in a way, force people to inadvertently talk about themselves in a way that might actually be quite distressing sometimes for the individual. But if this is, in a way, genetically programmed in the same way that storytelling may very well be something we've evolved to have, then the telling of dreams may have been subject to an evolutionary pressure. And we may even have our fictional plot-like, story-like nature of dreams as a result of evolutionary pressure is one possibility. So we've published something in Frontiers in Psychology a couple of years back, and we've just had a paper accepted in Dreaming on that possibility, that we've evolved to have these plot-like dreams, and the pressure has arisen through the benefit to the group when the dreams are told. So that's sort of the other end of the technological aspect, is going much more down the social aspect. But even though it's a social area of research to do with empathy and group processes, it actually could have a tie-in with evolution as well. And we've even put forward in the 2019 paper the possibility that maybe dreams within sleep have no function. They're an epiphenomenon. And when they start to be told, that's when the evolution took off for them. So they're all, whereas the Zadra and Sicholl book says that if there's a function to dreams, it must occur for unrecalled dreams, we have put forward the possibility that it may be that the function for dreams only occurs for recalled dreams, which we've liked the mischievousness of that, of throwing that out there.
That's extremely mischievous and a fascinating idea. And I think it's a wonderful place to stop. Thank you both so much. I have a list of other topics that I'd love to ask you about sometime. But I think at this point, I shouldn't take more of your time.
Season 3 of the podcast.
Yeah. If you're willing, I would love to have you back, and we'll continue at some point. But for now, thank you so much. You've been listening to the Sleep Science Podcast with me, Penny Lewis. My guests today were Professor Tore Nielsen from the University of Montreal and Professor Mark Blagrove from Swansea University. Our producer was Sophie Smith. If you've enjoyed this show, please consider subscribing to the podcast or liking us on Twitter. We're planning a Q&A session for the last episode of this series, so if you have questions about this episode or anything else sleep-related, please send them to us on Twitter at #SleepSciencePodcastQ&A. Thanks for listening, and until next time, sleep well.